Soon we'll be celebrating and observing the fall period of the Holy Day season. It's hard to think about that now when it's blazing hot outside. I don't know if the statistics bear me out, but it seems to be in memory the hottest August that we have ever remembered. I could be wrong, and I'm probably wrong. Somebody will come up with some fancy chart and prove me wrong, but it really seems to me that we've had less rain than we've had in other years and during this, quote, monsoon season, and soon that'll all be over. Cooler weather will prevail to some extent, at least in the evenings, and we'll finally have that autumnal chill in December. We're going to gather on specific days: Trumpets, Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles, and the Last Day. These are all on a calendar that we can look to and we can predict. Get your holy day calendar every year, right? Get it from the church. Denotes all the times and allows us to put it on our calendar. We can buy the calendar from the students at the home office, the Ambassador Bible College, and squint even more than we normally do while looking at those things on that calendar, 11 by 8 and a half magnet that goes on your refrigerator. What's that say? I guess I'm the only one. Well, the rest of you are wearing reading glasses, so you don't need to squint. I get it. Those are on a calendar, and we can observe them, and we can predict them. I mean, not that we predicted them, but others have predicted them. They're there. They're the time, you know, they go far into the future, and we can generally understand when those days will fall in the Roman calendar. Generally speaking, I'm sure that you're aware that the Bible says something about the last 3.5 years prior to Jesus' return. And you're right. There are actually 7 specific mentions of a 3.5 year time period in the Bible. And those 7 mentions of a 3.5 year time period show us 5 specific events of the end time. You could make a case for 6, maybe even more, but I just make a case for 5 today, and it's my sermon, so I'm going to stick with 5, okay? The title is 5 Events in 3.5 Years or More. Because there's also, and we'll cover this briefly, it's not the focus of the sermon, there's also mention of an additional 30 days in Daniel 12 and an additional 75 days in Daniel, 1,290 days, 1,335 days. What does all that mean? I'll give you some of my thoughts. We've never really defined it, made it something that you have to memorize or that I'll tell you at the end of the service, take out half a sheet of paper, number it from 1 to 10. We're going to have a little quiz. Hand them in to my wife, Terry, please. Put your name on them. We'll grade them. No, just kidding. My brother was talking about doing that this week. I guess that's on my mind. He was talking about having a 30-minute sermon and then having a test afterwards. I said, kind of don't do that. Don't do that. Don't give him a test. He gave it to me, and I got 100%, but, you know, I don't do it for them. It was true false. I'll give you a hint in case he ever gives it to you. All the answers are false. Just put F down on every one. 7 questions. Oh, my. So I said, look, he said, why not? I said, people don't like tests. They don't want to take tests. He says, well, I'm concerned that they're not going to remember what I spoke on. I said, well, don't worry about that. They're not going to remember what you spoke on. You don't have to worry about that. Just try to get them in the moment. What happens in the last 3.5 years before Christ's return is a very important aspect of Bible prophecy for us to study and to understand. But I want to emphasize this, not for the purpose of trying to identify some elaborate scheme or timeline, or trying to figure out things, or who, the what, and when, the where, the how, the why, and the how. And to be specific as far as, okay, I know it's going to happen in June. I know it's going to happen in this year. No. That's not why we should study it. It's not for the purpose of establishing a timeline. But the 3.5 years mentioned at the end of man's history is very important, and it's mentioned 7 specific times in several different ways, and you've probably seen them. And we're going to cover all of those as they describe the events that are shown within that particular time frame. So it describes 5 specific events. I could go to 6, 5. If I give you a test, you could probably remember 5, right? Put all your notes away, number from 1 to 5. No, we won't do that. The first one is found in Revelation chapter 12. And this is a chapter that is an inset chapter. It's a very important chapter. They're all important. But it's important in understanding this one thing that I actually kind of told you, that these 1,260 days and these times and half a time, which are mentioned, all the same thing, same period of time, and then 42 months, that's 3.5 years. 3.5 year time period is mentioned 7 specific times. Okay, this is the outlier. So I did kind of lead you astray, because this one does not speak about the last 3.5 years of man's history, so to speak, or the time just prior to Christ's return. You have to understand how the Bible does interpret its symbols, and most of you do. You have to understand this mention of 1,260 days, not in a literal 3.5 year period, but in a different frame of mind. Okay? So it is an outlier. It is different than the rest, but it's mentioned in terms of end-time Bible prophecy, and it does occupy that space, and it will fill that space, as you will see, and you probably understand. As you probably understand, but it is an outlier, and you should understand that. We find this mention of 1,260 days in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 6. It says, "Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. In the other 4 times, or pardon me, the other, I'm getting my numbers mixed up, in the other 6 times, the 3.5 years are mentioned prior to the return of Jesus Christ, they all refer to a 3.5 year time period. This one does not. But it's in the scope of end time prophecy, and it's mentioned, so I wanted to leave it with you. What does this one have to do with? This time period is the outlier of the other mentions of 1,260 days, or a time, times, and half a time, or 42 months. Because of this one of the 7, this one is to be understood in the same way as the day for a year principle in Numbers. Remember, Israel was withheld from going into the promised land a year for every day that they rebelled in the wilderness, or 40 years. In the same way, this is to be understood as well. This is a prophecy about a woman. Beginning in verse 1, you see, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars." Perhaps we can go into another time the detail associated with this, but the 12 stars refer to the 12 tribes of Israel. "Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child." You'll notice child is capitalized. The C is. "As soon as it was born." That happened. There's a prophecy, of course, that would relate to the killing of all male children in and around the area of Jerusalem by Herod in an attempt to kill the Christ child. The wise men at the time were very oblique in giving information to Herod because they knew what might happen. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations. This is obviously speaking of the church. The she here is who? We'll get to that. In verse 2, it shows the woman giving birth. The dragon is ready to devour a child. The child is obviously Jesus Christ. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 5 says that she bore a male child who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And that will happen at the return of Jesus Christ. And her child was caught up to God and his throne. And that happened after his physical life on this earth. His physical mother was Mary, but he was also a descendant of Israel, being of Judah, so he was from Israel. The woman here is physical Israel, but not just physical Israel. Note, hold your place there, note in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 6. Try to let the Bible describe its own symbols here. Galatians chapter 4, verse 6. Wrong scripture here. Let me find it. Sorry. I know I'm in the same area. I know I'm in the proper area. So while I'm trying to remember that, I remember what it does say is that Jerusalem above is free and the mother of us all. So if somebody finds that passage, then you can alert me to it quietly, quietly. Don't yell it out. Get taught on tape. But in verse 16 of chapter 6, we find this, "And as many as walk according to this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God." Israel is the mother of us all from the standpoint of a spiritual sense. It's also speaking of spiritual Israel, because Paul says that everyone in the church is a part of the Israel which is from above. So how are we to understand this time period of 1260 days in Revelation 12 and verse 6? Since the context in verse 6 is historical and not prophetic, it was prophetic for John, and it was of great prophetic significance to John because it would focus on a time in the future, but that time for us is now past. The woman is the church, and it's speaking of a historical reference that happened beginning in 325 AD. The church did flee, and by order of the newly converted pagan emperor Constantine in 325, as we have covered in other topics before, all Sabbath keepers were banned from the Roman Empire. All Jews, the Church of God, were forced to flee or to go undercover, and they did so for a period of 1,260 years. That time period covers the eras of three churches of God that are mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3, the areas of Smyrna, Pergamos, and Thyatira. The Church of God then migrated to Europe, then to the south of France, eventually to the British Isles, and finally, in 1585, the British Isles was able to eventually give birth, so to speak, to the Sardis era of God's church, as Sabbath keepers were able to observe their faith after the death of Mary, Queen of Scots, who is Catholic by her religion. And Protestantism and other religions began to flourish in the British Isles at that time, and eventually we trace church history to Newport, Rhode Island. But the mention of 1260 days in this particular in this particular chapter is from a historical point of view, and it covers the day for a year period, or 1260 years. So now the title changes to four events in 3.5 years, foreign events, but you get the point. Turn to Revelation 11, just a page back. The second major event of the last 3.5 years brings a great conflict between the people of God that will be very difficult for us to imagine now, in the form of two witnesses against and aligned against two powerful figures during that time, the beast and the false prophet, the political and the religious leaders of the final beast empire. Revelation 11 and verse 3, "And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth." Now, some people think, and some commentaries and analysts think, that this refers to two churches or the church itself. But it doesn't really seem possible, because these two individuals are actually going to be killed, as it shows in this chapter. It says, "These are two olive trees and two lampstands standing before the God of the earth." In the book of Zechariah, let's hold our places there and turn to Zechariah. These two individuals in this circumstance is also mentioned in the book of Zechariah in chapter 4. And I'll cite this because it refers back to something that is happening, or something that was prophesied in both of these chapters to happen. It has to do with angelic beings. Closing in on Zechariah. In verse 1, it introduces the angelic being. It says, "Now the angel who talked with me came back and wakened me as a man who's wakened out of his sleep. And he said to me, 'What do you see?' And I said, 'I am looking, and there's a lampstand of solid gold with a bowl on top of it. And on the stand, seven lamps with seven pipes to the seven lamps. Two olive trees are by it, one at the right of the bowl and the other at its left.' So I answered and spoke to the angel who talked with me and saying, 'What are these, my Lord?' And in verse 14, he answered, said, 'These are the two anointed ones who stand before the Lord of the whole earth.'" It appears then that the two witnesses mentioned in Revelation, the same two individuals that are mentioned here in Zechariah, it's possible, I guess, that we may know who these people are. Well, we don't know them or who they are now, but it's possible that we may know them. I don't know if that's likely. I don't even know if they're alive today. I don't know if they'll be born in a future generation. A long time ago, we all thought that we had this figured out. It was so neat and so easy to understand. It was simple. Back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we knew exactly who these individuals were going to be, didn't we? But we don't know. We don't know who the two witnesses will be. But it appears that they're going to be two specific individuals. Maybe you've come in contact with them. Maybe you haven't. But that doesn't really matter, because trying to predict who they might be is a fool's errand. It doesn't really do anyone any good at all. That's not why we study Bible prophecy. We don't study Bible prophecy to get into that specific detail. Maybe later on it'll be important, it'll be evident, but it's not evident and important at this particular time. So unless you have an extra special revelation, and I'm not going to always discount that, I don't think you do, but unless you do, you and I don't know who this is. It says in verse 5 of Revelation 11, "If anyone wants to harm them, and as they come in conflict with the beast and the false prophet," and they definitely will come in conflict with the beast and the false prophet, "they're not going to all be operating in a vacuum. There are four individuals who are going to have some supernatural power on the earth at that particular time, and they're not going to be away from each other. There's going to be great conflict between all four of them. If anyone wants to harm them, fire proceeds from their mouth and devours their enemies. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think I'd want to have that kind of power. But they're going to have it. And they're going to have to use it judiciously. And they're going to have to understand a lot. But it may be way off in the horizon, or maybe not too far off in the horizon. We don't know. But these two people are going to have a great deal of power. In Psalm 97, it shows that fire is something that is synonymous with the judgment of God. So if God allows it and God gives them this particular power and it's exercised on people, as it looks like it will, it's because those individuals are going to deserve it. Psalm 97, the Lord reigns, let the earth rejoice, let the multitude of the isles be glad. Clouds and darkness surround him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. A fire goes before him and burns up his enemies round about. His lightnings light the world, and the earth sees and trembles. Of course, this will be accompanying Christ at his return. But that same power, godly power, is available to the two witnesses. Back to Revelation 11. They have the power to shut heaven so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy. And they have the power over the waters to turn them to blood and to strike the earth with all plagues as often as they may desire. This is the power that was given to only two people in recorded Bible history that we know of, Elijah and Moses. And when they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them and overcome them and kill them. So these are individuals that will be alive at a time prior to Christ's return. And they'll be summoned for the last 3.5 years to do a very special job. Their entire job is not mentioned here. It's mentioned in various other places. Note the last two verses of the book of Malachi for a hint as to what these two individuals will do for 3.5 years. 3.5 years, which leads us to, I think, some conclusions. And I'll try not to get ahead of myself. I'll try to give those at the end. You're probably well aware of me. But in the last book, in the last chapter of the Old Testament, there are, I think you can see the alignment here, the specific prophecies of these two individuals and what they will do. Notice the time period, Malachi 4 and verse 1. Behold, the day is coming, burning like an oven, and all the proud, yes, all who do wickedly, will be stubble. That'll happen at Christ's return, right? And the day which is coming shall burn them up, says the Lord of hosts. That will leave them neither root nor branch. And it could refer to several times in prophecy in the future, but I think it certainly refers to the return of Christ. But to you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall also arise with healing in his wings, and you shall go out and grow like stall-fed calves. You shall trample the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet. On the day that I do this, says the Lord of hosts. Refers perhaps to a very long period of time of prophecy, maybe over 1,000 years from the time of Christ's return until the time of the white throne judgment. But it also says, remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes. And behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. In other words, the last sentence means that if this did not happen, and if this work was not done, if the law of Moses was not brought to remembrance, and it appears to me for a great number of people, not just a few, for a future time and not just today, the work of Moses, the work of the two witnesses, the work that we've always called an Elijah-type work, a work that was similar to John the Baptist, but I believe will be much greater than the work of John the Baptist because he led people to repentance and a baptism of repentance. But I believe this work will lead to a time of the conversion of millions of people during a very specific period of time that the Bible shows to be 1,260 days, time times and half a time, or 42 months. The two witnesses, I believe, will have that power and that they will convert many. Because if they don't, there's almost no use saving the rest of the earth. It would be just worthy of a curse. But I think they're going to do an incredible work. The work of the two witnesses will fulfill the prophecy of the Elijah to come. And I believe that there will be many added to the church of God during that time. Now, today, you have United Church of God. You have a number of other very fine people scattered in a number of groups. But if you're just taking a look at this church, it's very small. Maybe 2,000 families around the world supporting what we do. It's not always going to be like that. Now, it's going to be very difficult circumstances, but I believe it's going to be huge because the conditions will help people to be motivated to understand what these two witnesses and what the church has said prior to that time. So what you're doing now, by your observance of the Sabbath, your observance of the holy days, your daily prayers, your tithes, offerings, and everything that you do within the context of your devotion to God is laying a groundwork for all of this. It's very important work that you're doing. Very important that you're here. Very important that you're committed to that because these people will come from you. All of these innumerable multitude that come out of Revelation 6, 7, the great tribulation, there's going to be a lot of deception. There's going to be a lot of problem. There's going to be a lot of horror. There's going to be a lot of difficulty. But there's also going to be a great many people who are converted during that particular time. The work of the two witnesses will be like the work of Elijah in restoring the knowledge of the true God, as he did in ancient Israel, when he thought that there was nobody around that observed or knew the true God like he did. And God told him, I've got 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal. Just a small number, but there's a lot of people out there. It's not always going to be a small work. It may be a much larger work during the time of this great tribulation than it ever has been. Much larger than what we see now. Verse 7 of Revelation 11, when they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them. Two people, war against two people. Overcome them, kill them, and their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified in Jerusalem. That's why I say they will be in direct conflict with the beast and the false prophet, because they'll also be there. Now, I don't know that the two witnesses will always be centered in Jerusalem. I don't know that. I can't say that. But it looks like they'll be there at the end of their lives, just prior to Christ's return. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry and send gifts to one another because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. Supernatural power. Don't think I'm ready for that. Don't think any of us are ready for that kind of power. Now after 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered them and they stood on their feet and great fear fell on those who saw them. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. Now, is that coincidental to the time of Jesus' return? Probably, I guess. Appears so. The resurrection mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Thessalonians 4. But we'll wait and see on that. There's a lot we have to wait and see on, right? So that's the second of seven times in which 1,260 times and half a time and 42 months is mentioned in the Bible. And the first of four end time events, if you're counting. Am I confusing you? Joe? Confusing? Number three, Revelation 12 and verse 4. The third major event. And boy, we sure want to be, if we're live at this time, well, we sure want to be here, don't we? Yep. Revelation 12 and verse 4. Verse 14, sorry. Got it in my notes right. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the language is similar to what it mentions earlier in the chapter, the woman going into the wilderness. That was for 1,260 days, which I think separates it from this particular occurrence. We know time, times, and half a time. I'm not going to go into the explanation. Also means 3.5 years. The 1,260 days, though, the Bible can interpret that as the day for a year principle, and I think it has worked out that way, 1,260 years. This time, times, and half a time are the last 3.5 years, and the church is protected from the serpent. The serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. Woman is a synonym for church. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now in Revelation 11 and verse 1, notice this. Revelation 11 and verse 1. I know we've talked about the two witnesses already, but speaking about something else here specifically. Revelation 11 and verse 1, it says, "Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, 'Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there.'" Now, what is being measured here has sometimes been a source of controversy among the commentators of the Bible. But we can see very easily that there are three things that are being measured. An angel is measuring them. An angel also measured Jerusalem in Zechariah 4. It's measuring the temple, though, and the altar and those who worship there. Now, how does the Bible interpret that? You know. Because I'm sure that if I ask you to turn to a chapter in the Bible, you could probably turn to it right now, which describes the temple of God. You know where it is. Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2 and verses 19 through 21 speak of a spiritual temple. This angel then is measuring a temple. Who would be in that temple? Well, Paul describes that temple in chapter 2 of Ephesians in verse 19. "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." The household of God is God's temple. "Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets," that is God's church. The apostles were responsible for writing and putting together the New Testament. The prophets put together the Old Testament. Our lives are built on the writings that God inspired through those men. And Jesus Christ, of course, being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. So that's the temple that the angel is measuring. Who's in that temple? He's measuring to determine the size of the temple, or actually who's in the temple of God. He's also measuring the altar. And the altar is described in chapter 13 of the book of Hebrews. Chapter 13 of the book of Hebrews in verse 10. It's important to remember what is going on in that temple. The altar is a very important part of that temple. The altar is the area to which we always have access, a place historically that mankind never had access before until Jesus Christ's death. When he died, the temple veil, whoop, I'm sure it was louder than that, rent in two, Matthew 27:51. And access was granted to man to go into that holy of holy areas. So Hebrews says, we have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. They couldn't do it. The priest could not do it. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. Eventually, that is New Jerusalem in Revelation 21. Therefore, by him, let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. That's where the sacrifices will take place in the future. That's where they take place now, at that altar, with the praise of God's people. But do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. Under the old covenant, forgiveness was provided through a sacrificial system. Under the new covenant, described fully in the book of Hebrews, we're provided forgiveness by and through the throne room of God. It's at that same altar. The altar was within the Holy of Holies. Only one person ever went in there, and only once a year, the high priest on the Day of Atonement. It is a place of judgment. Leviticus shows us that. The Day of Atonement foreshadowed the time in which sin would be forgiven upon repentance, and the altar pictures a place of righteousness, forgiveness, mercy, grace, and those standards are applied to all who go there. So who goes? Hebrews 4, verse 16 says, let us come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. The angel was also told to measure those who worship there. Well, we know that 1 Peter chapter 4, 17 says that that time now, that time of measurement is taking place in the house of God, in the people of God. Now is our time. Well, people get so concerned about the future, right? And I write about prophecy every week. I try to fully explain why I'm doing it. Kind of keeps my head in the game, but it's not for the purpose of understanding when these things will happen. It's for the purpose of admonishing me in my own life as to what my responsibilities are now. Now, people get, you know, I've known these people, right? I've known them in the church from the time that I came into the church. I've known people who could fill up all the walls of this room with charts and dates and specific timelines and all of that sort of stuff. And they got it all worked out. I had one individual that I knew had what he called the Rubik's Cube of prophecy. Really? You know, click, click, click. Nobody understands it like I do. Have you seen people with, You know, you get a six-year-old and teach them how to use the Rubik's Cube, and they go, dip, 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 and it's all back to normal. You seen those? YouTube it. Don't tell me you don't know what YouTube is. You find people go, dip, 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 dip. This guy figured he was the Rubik's Cube master of prophecy. All the walls covered with dates and events of the future. That's not why we study these things. The reason we study these things is because it brings an imposition upon our lives. You know, what manner of persons ought we to be? That's why I look into world events. That's why I'm interested. That's why you should be interested, because now is really what's really important for us, not the future. I mean, now the future is like this next instant, right? This one. But it's right now. It's the present time which should concern us and our actions. But the measuring of an angel involves the evaluation of God's spiritual temple, the church of God, his people, and their practices. And we're defined by what we believe and how we conduct our lives. Elsewhere in the book of Revelation, in the church, in the message to the churches of the various areas, we see that measurement is taking place. And you can read that in Revelation chapter 2 and 3. Christ is evaluating his church. That process is ongoing, and it involves trials of the faith. There will always be those. There will be other opportunities to prove ourselves faithful to our calling. But we're responsible right now on an ongoing basis. Now, notice verse 2 of Revelation 11. And you really need to understand this if you haven't before. Okay? Because it does involve your future. It does involve many people that you come into contact with. And you need to be aware that everything I've said applies to you. It doesn't apply to anyone that God has not called. Because it says, leave out the court, which is outside the temple. That's not being measured. Do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. That's a part of a large group of people who will be deceived. His Bible prophecy shows that many people will be deceived during the time of the end. Which brings us to the fourth or the third major event of the last 3.5 years. Jerusalem will be occupied for 42 months. 3.5 years. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15. Matthew 24 and verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. It will be so great, as it says in the next verse, that if God did not intervene... It's all going to happen according to a timetable, okay? But if God did not intervene, no flesh could be saved. Now, the potential to kill everybody and everything on the planet has existed for a while, and the means to deliver it, technically speaking, and it just gets worse and worse every day, right? But this is the abomination of desolation, when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. Now, it appears that there could be people of God, the Church of God in Jerusalem at this time. And like their ancient spiritual, historical ancestors, time to get out when this happens. Time to get out of Jerusalem. Now, it's hard for us to imagine that. I don't think we have any members living in Jerusalem now. But we will. I'm pretty sure of that. We will have people that are in the church in the future in Jerusalem. I don't know when. I don't know how. But I don't think that this was just a warning to the time period between 66 and 70 AD. Because a lot of this was still being organized and put together. The gospel accounts and readied. So Christ told his disciples this. This was something that was understood by the church, and they fled to Pella. And they fled to Jordan. And they escaped. They say that there were 1 million Jews that were killed during that occupation by Roman forces in 70 AD. And then later in 168, or earlier, pardon me, in 168 BC, the same thing had happened. This is what is referred to here, Antiochus Epiphanes, coming into Jerusalem, one of the descendants of the four kingdoms of Greece, came into Jerusalem, took it over, put a statue of Jupiter into the temple where the temple had been, and sacrificed swine's blood on the altar, according to tradition, according to some of the histories like Josephus. History can repeat itself. Why will they be there? Luke 21. Luke 21 and verse 20. Luke 21 and verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. That is what makes Jerusalem desolate. Everything happens after that time period. Maybe a reenactment. We have some clues. We have some indications in Daniel. It's a very broad, general prophecy, so you're at your own risk if you try to be too specific on this. But Daniel 11 and verse 40 speaks of the time of the end, right? At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots. King of the north, we know who that is. That's the beast. That's the beast which will arise out of, you know, which is, we're shown in Revelation 13, that John sees that vision of the beast rising up out of the Mediterranean Sea. Seven heads, 10 horns, etc., etc. A dominant force in the last 3.5 years of man's history. So this king of the north brings his army, surrounds Jerusalem, and notice what else. It says, verse 45, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Yep, that's detailed in Revelation 19, beast and false prophet thrown into a place called the lake of fire. Done with. So Jerusalem occupied for 42 months. That's when you don't want to be in Jerusalem anymore. Just in case you get there. Which reminds me of the funny story of a friend of my father-in-law's who maintained that he needed to have a ticket, open ticket, always, some airline to go to Jerusalem. Lee said, well, why do you need that? He says, well, I need to be in Jerusalem so I can get out. Okay. All right, that's fine. That's his interpretation. He needs to be there so he can leave. If you're not there, then you don't have to leave, I guess. But I don't know. But just that didn't make sense to me. But the last thing, the last of the four events, if you'll excuse what I did earlier, the war against the saints. You're still in Daniel. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 7. This is something that is mentioned several times in the context of the seven mentions of 1,260 days, time, times, and half a time, or 42 months. Daniel 7 and verse 20. The ten horns that were on its head and the other horn which came up after which these three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows, I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came. They're also going to make war against the two witnesses. So the two witnesses will be a part of that, and there will be a lot of people that come to the truth during that 3.5 year period, and the beast power and this little horn, it's going to be the religious leader, is going to make war against them. The church will use the state to make war against these folks, just as it always has through history, but in a much grander scale. And I think there will be a lot more people involved. In verse 25, it says, this little horn here, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. That's also mentioned elsewhere, and we'll cover that in just a bit. Shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law, undoubtedly. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Another instance in which it is mentioned. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 5. This, of course, is where this is all so confusing to Daniel, right? Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this river bank and the other on that river bank. And one said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, so I guess suspended above, I guess, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? Then I heard the man clothed in linen, who is above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and swore by him who lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered. Not fun times. Not looking forward to that. It's going to happen, because there's going to be war made upon them by the religious head of the Holy Roman Empire when it arises, and God's people will be shattered. Now go back to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13 and verse 5. Now, the purpose here is definitely not to scare. I've done scary sermons in the past. Sometimes I've tried to do that. That was years ago, back in my Austin days. You know, I was a changed person after I left there. You've all heard the scary sermon. You know, we don't need that. There are things that are scary, though, right? And you can't avoid them. But not to make us fearful. They're to help us to understand what is going to happen. And if it does that, it's just a byproduct of the truth. There's an old expression that I can't use in a sermon that Harry Truman said one time about the truth, and I can't use it. So you can look it up. Revelation 13 and verse 5. Revelation 13 and verse 5 speaks about this same one. And Daniel says same thing that, John says same thing that Daniel did. This individual is going to be blasphemous against God. And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. So it'll be a short, lived type of reign on this earth, the beast power and the false prophet. And then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Now, When you read that last sentence, it's hard to visualize that in this day and age in which there are like, what, 185, almost 200 nations in the world, and then there's territories and all these different governments. It's hard to imagine one person having authority over all people on earth. Can you imagine that? No, I can't either. It's tough, but that's what's going to happen. All authority over the entire earth, everyone. Yeah, will there be independent nations? Sure. But they're going to be humming the same bar of music that this guy does. They're going to be in line in simpaccato because they'll be deceived. All who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And why? Because they're deceived. 1 Thessalonians 4 talks about this man of sin. He'll be revealed. Paul indicates in Thessalonians, no time to go there. Paul indicates in Thessalonians that this system was already at work because it was anti-God. It hadn't been completely revealed yet, and if you'll read through 1 Thessalonians, you'll see that. But it's coming upon the world scene. So all authority is given him over every tribe and nation and people, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Studying these events, I'd just like to close with a few conclusions, just something that came to me personally, something that, you know, I felt. The church of God today is splintered. Some might say fractured into various organizations. However, if you examine our own history, going back to the apostasy of 1995 and even before that, it's obvious today, retrospectively, that maybe many observed all that we observe today still, either did so because they conformed, or maybe they were not converted, or maybe they were converted and they've fallen away. That's not us, that's not our part to judge. Maybe they have been deceived. That's not our task. God hasn't given us that task. Thankfully, it's not ours. We can't do anything about that. The church of God in the future will most likely be a lot larger than it is today. Prior to Christ's return, we see an aging church, aging ministry. We don't see a lot of growth. That's going to change. It's going to change. Whatever you do today is building towards that in the future. There'll be a lot of people that'll be shaking your hand in the resurrection. Thanks for hanging in there. Thanks for not giving up. Thanks for overcoming in spite of trial and problem and heresy and difficulty and illness. A lot of people are going to be very thankful. As you're very thankful for all the people that ever preceded you, whether it was your crazy uncle that talked you into something, they seemed rabid in their conviction, or your brother, or others who sometimes had, let's face it, misguided zeal, but still they hung in there. Church is likely to be a lot larger than it is today, certainly through the Great Tribulation. Now, in Daniel 12, I said I'd get to this, and I am here at the end. Daniel 12 and verse 12, what does this mean? Well, I'm not sure that I have the total answer, but let's go for what we have now. Daniel 12 and verse 12. there is a blessing pronounced on he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. Now that's 2.5 months prior to the time period that we've been speaking about, 75 days. I believe all the days begin and end at the same time, or they all end at the same time. The 1,335, the 1,290 that is also mentioned here, and the 1,260. They all end around the time of Christ's return. But a blessing is pronounced on the person that waits for 1,335 days. So that's 2.5 months longer than 3.5 years, right? It says that, verse 11, from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. So that's 30 days more. So that wouldn't be unusual, would it? For this king of the north to be able to assemble and converge on Jerusalem and have that period of time of setting up, overtaking Jerusalem, and then finally, you know, being attacked by the king of the south and attacking back, a month's period of time. But what about this 1,335 days? The reason I say that I think that they all conclude at the same time is this. There's also a blessing that is pronounced upon those in Revelation 20 and verse 6 who are part of the first resurrection. And we know that that takes place at Christ's return. The dead in Christ shall rise first, and all those of us who remain. Okay. So this, I believe, is a 75-day time period prior to the 1,260 days of the Great Tribulation, which, to me, means that those individuals who are mentioned in Revelation 12 who are protected and taken away to a wilderness, those individuals will have time to prepare to be protected by God for that 3.5 years of great tribulation. The prophecies of the survival of the church of God through the ages. The two witnesses, God's people being protected or persecuted, and the great tribulation are all bound up in a very short period of time. It won't last long, thankfully. So when we study these events, again, it is not for the purpose of understanding a timeline, trying to avoid some kind of difficulty or problem, or saving ourselves, or drawing up charts, or pinpointing times on a future calendar. It's for the purpose of drawing closer to God and humbly acknowledging that he has granted us entry to his throne of grace so that we can live our lives under law. Because we know that when we live our lives under law, we are helping protect all of those that we come in contact with.